We left off right. Wow, that helps a little bit. We left off at talking about to ins do the actual installation of the operating system. Belborn, would you please? Don't do that now. And sorry about that. Okay, there's where we were. Sorry.
Earphone.
I think the last thing we did was the activity. Sorry, doing this like half lecture thing.
You know what we do? That you might want to try, is put a star or a symbol where you finished, and then you'll be able to find your place easily.
Think we were going to talk about installation next. That was, I think, the last bit.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Melbourne, can you please chew your bone elsewhere? All right. First of all, one of the biggest things you want to do with when you're about to do an installation. And they talk about this a little bit in the chapter, but I really want to emphasize this. You want to first make sure that before you do anything, make sure that the hardware that make sure that and we've talked about this a little bit, but this is mentioned a couple times. Before you do anything, you may want to make sure that your hardware meets the specifications, is going to support the operating system that you want to install. And make sure that not only that, because bad voice sensitivity. Make sure your hardware is going to support it, not only that it meets the technical minimum specifications, but and they mention this a little bit in the chapter, but it really does it really is something that you want to make sure that not only the minimum specifications, but a lot of this a lot of times the minimum specifications are set to the bare minimum. And if you those bare minimums are going to be really painful if you try and if it only meets those bare minimums, you want to they will give you bare minimum and they will give you recommended. And even the recommended can sometimes be on a little bit on the low side. I would really urge you to do your research when you go to do your operating installation before you do go to do an operating installation. Check not only the operating system websites, but check third party reviews from various there are a lot of publications out there that will give you a more balanced idea of what specifications really are a good and are going to be good enough for trying to run the operating system that you're looking at on. So that's before you do anything, you really want to check into that. The next thing that you want to do once you've checked into that, Back up your data. No matter what you do, whether you're doing an upgrade, because whether even, I mean, if you're doing the upgrade, you know, we already gave our spiel on our thoughts on upgrades. And even if you believe the upgrades are beautiful line that they and even if an upgrade does work to the best of the worlds, you still want to make a backup of data. Always make a backup, and it's always a good idea to be making backups anyway, but especially when you're doing anything major like this, make a backup and make sure it's a backup that is a backup that is not going to be impacted in cannot be impacted in any way by the computer that you are going to be working on. Another thing, and probably I should have said this before even doing the backup, because and even possibly the hardware, because some of this could be on this, but make a checklist. And I can't emphasize this enough, especially when you're working for an employer. Make checklists. Because when you're doing work for an employer, and especially when you're going to be working on a lot of machines, it is so easy to get started on something, and the more machines you're working on, it is so easy to get started on something come up and you get distracted by something and you can forget to do something along the line. So make a checklist. Make it a detailed checklist. You know, this really can help you. Yeah, it may seem tedious, and you know, this is a lesson that I had to learn the hard way a little bit. You know, when I started doing IT stuff, I started in a small operation. And they didn't necessarily have us do anything, you know, because it was a small operation. They didn't have us do checklists. And so I thought, oh, you know, we don't need those. And I wasn't until I moved into trying to handle bigger projects and started making mistakes, and those mistakes got me into trouble. That I finally found out that checklists really could be useful. Because whether you're good at multitasking or not, sooner or later, you will forget things. I don't care how good you at remembering things you are, sooner or later you will forget things, because when you are doing IT work, you can get busy. I may have taken a little more time than I needed to on that one, but it really is an important lesson to learn when you're doing IT work. I really want to make sure that you guys learn from my mistakes. But when going through an installation process like this, you really do want to make a checklist. But yeah, make up a backup of the data. Another thing that you want to make sure that you guys look into this beforehand, and this dovetails into the hardware that we talked about. When you are when you are doing a operating system installation, you want to take note of the hardware you're going to be using and make sure that you have the drivers that you are going to need. And this is important for a couple of reasons. One, you would think that, you know, now in this age of plug and play, that, Windows 7, you know, it should, or Linux, Ubuntu, you know, you would think that, oh, it should have the drivers you are going to need. Not always. A lesson I learned, I got reminded of fairly recently, in fact. They are getting better and better of how about having generic drivers, but they certainly do not always have the drivers that you will want and need.
Ain't that the truth?
In fact, I think I will give you a couple examples because, like I said, I like you guys to learn from my mistakes so you don't have to repeat my mistakes and you don't have to look like idiots. At my last IT type job that I worked, we had a couple computers that, oh, and I'm, before I tell this story, I'm going to add to it. Not only make sure you have the drivers, but make sure you have these drivers in as low level a form as possible. Or can get them in as low level form as possible. This could mean as much as having those drivers. I mean having them on, possibly having them burn to a CD with you. And here is why. At my last IT job, we had some computers that we were working with that were, we had some computers that weren't, that were a couple years behind behind the newest stuff. It wasn't too old, but a little bit older. And what we ran into is we, you know, formatted it. Now, these machines were running XP. They weren't Windows 7 machines. So hopefully, but you still can run into this stuff even with Windows 7. The lesson still holds. We've put brand new copy of XP on these machines, and, you know, set it up, Yahoo. Well, ran into a very bad problem. You see, these machines, they booted up fine and all that, but, we ran into the fact that the drivers, the generic drivers that XP came with, really didn't do the job for these machines. And what I mean, when I say didn't do the job, I really mean that the USB ports didn't even work. And this was at a blindness center. So most of us, in the IT area, were fairly good at problem solving, but that usually meant slapping in a USB sound card and getting access that way. That wasn't very good for us. What we found out the problem was that the drivers that we needed were the chipset drivers. for that motherboard. Because without the chipset drivers, you couldn't get the USB ports to work. Without the USB ports to work, you couldn't even get thumb drives to work, or USB sound cards to work, or anything else to work. But I tell you that story to just, you know, most people wouldn't even think about the fact that most people don't think about the fact that drivers like that just wouldn't come up and working, but you will still come across the fact that a lot of drivers like that don't come working.
Just a
Ethernet
really
drivers.
Quick one. Windows 98, mm-hmm. the default drivers that came with the Realtek 8139 cards, which are very prolific, didn't actually function out of the box, and it wasn't until you went and got the ones from Realtek that the card would come up and be stable. The card would run for about 5 minutes on the embedded drivers, but you actually had to push the Realtek ones to fix some problem that had gone out in the drivers that were actually shipped with Windows 98. So yeah, it's more common than you'd think. It's pretty scary stuff.
The one I see most often though is network card drivers, which you'll get most often. You'll get the motherboard to basically function. You'll get the sound card drivers to sometimes function. But what I see most often that you're dead in the water, not functioning without downloading the drivers from someplace, are the network card drivers, whether that be your wireless card or Ethernet card, which is kind of ironic because you can't download drivers without an internet connection, and if you don't get those from somewhere else, you can't download them without an internet network card. So that catch 22 if you don't download them beforehand. So that might have been a long-winded story, but just make sure you get your drivers beforehand.
One very quick comment, actually. I don't know if anybody's aware of these, but has anybody seen the little CDRWs you can get? Little tiny ones, about 60 mil across or something? They store 180 meg.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of them.
I've seen them. They're very nice, yeah.
Very handy
I've
for tech work.
I've only seen the mini DVDs.
You can get either, but you can actually get CDRWs that store 180 meg or mini DVDs that store 2.4 gig. And having one in your techie kit, if you can find them, is really handy because you can fill them up with all the drivers you think you're going to want, and unless your machines have got slot loaders, you will be able to install them. And Murphy's Law says that the ones that you're going to need to install them on will have slot loaders, but it does cover one more eventuality.
Indeed.
So is there a way I can get kind of default drivers that will work for, you know, like everything at least fairly well, and then update them again if I need to, because I'm thinking of installing Windows 7 on a machine and I don't actually know what hardware it has, so would I be best just getting onto that machine and then getting the drivers before I install the new OS?
Windows 7's pretty good.
I'm not sure
good.
I understand you.
You can never get all the drivers you need for every machine that you're going to need easily, unless you know the manufacturer of all the components, and then you run around all the websites and pick them up, and that's quite time consuming. Driver Agent is good, but until it runs Windows 7, actually no, there's a thing on Driver Agent where you can point it with the current operating system and then go, I want to run Windows 7, and it'll make you up a zip of all of the drivers you need for Windows 7. And I saw that on there the other day.
Okay.
So I'm upgrading my operating system, and then you get one big zip of drivers. And then you install Windows 7 and you load the drivers out of the zip and you're good to go. We love Driver Agent. Sorry, sponsored announcement ends.
So, okay,
I've
so those drivers would be fairly fairly up to date and stuff? Like more so than the out of the box Windows ones?
Driver Agent's drivers are going to be as up to date as the manufacturer's websites. You can't get more up to date unless
okay.
you go and like punch out the little people writing the drivers and nick their floppies out of their workstations. Yeah, how much more up-to-date do you want?
Fair enough.
Okay, The next thing that they get into, and I'm not going to get into this one much, but they do mention this in the chapter. As far as they do talk about how sometimes it is suggested to put the operating system on a separate partition and put the rest of the programs and documents on another partition. And I've seen pros and cons to that approach. You know, some will say that, you know, that's safer, and to some extent that probably is true. There's a little more setup to it, but yes, that you could. There's something to be said for that. There are different types of file systems, and we aren't going to, once again, this isn't something we're going to get into very much. The ones you're going to see for file systems, talk about a few different ones. As far as they talk about the FAT32 NTFS, EXT2, EXT3, you'll see NTFS is the main file system you'll see for XP and Windows 7 for operating system drives. You aren't going to see FAT or FAT32 much anymore, except for smaller drives such as like your media cards, and that sort of thing.
You will see FAT32 with some XP systems, but the majority of them are going to run NTFS. But your FAT32 is going to run
that's
on your
true.
Flash drives and on your probably on your CDs and DVDs too.
In the notes, it said that there are disadvantages and advantages for every file system type. Can you go for more details in this? Explain what are the disadvantages, for example, of NTFS FAT32?
Seeing that we're already going to be running behind time, I think that's going to be a bit beyond the scope of what we're going to be going into. If you really want more on that, we can probably get into that either after class or catch one of us later.
Do you want me to do a real, like, really, really, really short version of the advantages of NTFS over FAT32?
Please do, because they're going to ask about the.
Are they? Okay.
I just asked you to determine the needs, just to determine.
If you can do a 30-second summary, a minute summary, I think it'd probably do people a world of good.
Okay, I'll step in here for a minute. Pretty much, when you're going for NTFS has a lot more security than FAT32, and you're going to run into, let me see, there's a couple of different labs, I think, in IT Essentials that you will be doing that will show this. But you end up with a lot better file sharing security and a lot better security in general with NTFS over FAT32. So that's pretty much your main advantage to that. There's
but
your
also
30
in
second.
GFS you're allowed more files yeah. and stuff and bigger files as well, isn't that right?
I think your base file sizes are going to be bigger in NTFS. I think, if I remember correctly, your sector sizes are like 4K as compared to I don't remember what they are in FAT32. But that's pretty much it for the NTFS thing.
Do you want
there's your 30-second rundown. Disadvantages, I don't remember off the top of my head.
One of the disadvantages is on badly designed flash media, the journal will wear out the flash over time on NTFS.
Okay, does that help you out there?
Yep, definitely, thank you.
Alright, back to you, Nehemiah.
Okay, alright, this is the problem that we get into when I'm trying to figure out exactly. Alright. Alright, sorry about that.
The only other point I was going to make, because their mic's gone quiet for a bit there, was that if you use NTFS and you've got a Mac and you don't either use a third-party solution or a fuse and a lot of messing around, you can't actually do read-write to NTFS volumes, which is one of the reasons why a lot of Mac users keep their shared volumes in FAT32 so they can write to them natively on the Mac. But that said, Paragon NTFS and fuse are very good. If Barry has a comment to add, does anybody have a problem if he adds it? He's up late and sitting in. He won't be disruptive, I'm sure.
Go ahead. As far as I'm concerned, that's...
Okay. What's happening, guys? Is Nehemiah looking for something, or...?
Sorry, just... Okay. Alright, we,
Is there something we can help you with?
Yeah, I was getting ready to pull the chapter up and see where he was left off at.
Just a second.
I think we are about to talk about configuring a computer for the network. Maybe.
I think he may have lost his place.
Yeah.
It just let people know that, and then you can, and they can wait for you to find where you were.
Well, that's right. Geraldine used to hoik it to me. She'd go, right, installing system board devices, video cards, go, I'll be right back.
Yeah. Or she'd sing her scrolling song.
Okay. All right. When you are setting up the computer and getting it prepared for the network. There are two parts of doing that. The first part is the hardware part, the network interface card, which is your hardware, which could be a hardware connection, which we are. I think most of us have probably all seen, or wireless, which most of us have probably seen, but both of those qualify as as a network interface card. On the software side. You need the operating system needs three pieces of information. These three pieces of information can be either assigned by the network itself, or can be assigned by whoever is setting up the computer. These three pieces of information are the IP address, the subnet mask, and the default gateway. The IP address is a set of numbers that identify the computer on the network. In which we will be learning a lot more about fairly soon. The subnet mask identifies the network that the computer is connected to. And which is a well, that's a simplistic view, but you'll find out about more about that later. And the gate and the default gateway is the address of the device you use, the computer will use to reach other networks. In the case of in most cases, that means reaching the internet, but not always. But those are the three pieces of information that you need to provide most operating systems with to configure to set up the network connection. As I was saying before, those can be either assigned by the network, which we call dynamically assigned, or those can be assigned by whoever's setting up the computer, such as yourself or the a network administrator, and that is we call that being statically assigned. With Windows and some Linux operating systems as well, and with really a lot of modern operating systems, there is also a naming. You can also name the computer. And with that, there is the ability to implement naming schemes. When you do a naming scheme, it is very important to do so logically. Especially when you're setting something up in a organization that when you're doing so for an employer, naming schemes are applied to computers manually. There are some tools that can be used to help with that, but you do have to name computers manually. I don't remember if it said this in the chapter or not. I don't remember it actually saying this, but if it did, I just forgot so. But I put a note in here. Maybe it did. Make sure when you make a naming scheme, document it so that people that come behind you understand how the naming scheme works. When you do a naming scheme, usually how it works, how most people do it, is Basically, they will label two important pieces of information that are used are what type of device it is, such as computer or printer or server, and various things like that. But what kind of device or host it is, the location of that device, and then possibly like an like a number, like library server 1 or something of that sort. But naming schemes can be very beneficial to keeping track of devices, and because once you, especially once you start getting into a larger network, it really can help you figure out, you know, what a device is, where it is, what is or isn't working. It just makes your life easier when you're trying to keep track of things, or when you're trying to figure out maintenance schedules. There are several reasons to implement a naming scheme.
One point of information, real quick.
Mm-hmm.
When you obviously want unique names for your computers. If you're doing manual IP addressing, which, oh Lord, hopefully nobody has to, but thanks to the nice, wonderful DHCP. But anyway, your names and your IP addresses both have to be unique. Otherwise, if you go to share printers or other folders or whatever, then you are probably not going to have the easiest time doing it if you don't have unique names, unique IP addresses. Didn't catch if you mentioned that or not, but that's my point. Back to you.
No, I didn't, and that is a good point.
One other point, you can't have a computer name the same as the username. A lot of people don't realize that.
Say it again, sorry?
You cannot have a computer name the same as a username, so you cannot have a computer called Fred and a user called Fred on the same computer. You'll mess up the registration in the NetBIOS domain. So Fred's PC is okay, but you can't call the computer Fred and the user Fred.
Is it possible to have duplicate names in the same network?
No. You can have duplicate usernames, but you can't have duplicate computer names. Otherwise, how would you know which PC is Printer Muncher 74?
Any questions? I haven't actually outright asked if anyone has any questions about what we've covered so far.
And just a point, all guys, right. If you do have questions, if you could put your name in chat, then we'll recognize you that way. That's the way I've got to do it with my other class. So it seems to work. So yeah, just if you do have a question, just put your name in chat and we'll get to you.
Okay, and this brings us to everybody's favorite operating to OS maintenance, particularly updates. And we've already somewhat mentioned what a patch is, but to review, a patch is a code that is released that fixes or enhances an application or an operating system, and in relation to an operating system, which is what we're concentrating on at this point. Let's try that again. With operating systems, patches are very important. They are generally used to fix security holes that are discovered, to fix possible performance issues, But what I, you know, what I see most often are, you know, security holes being plugged. And another type that just gets discussed are service packs, which are basically major bundle major ser which are nothing more really than a really large major patch or a bundle of patches. And who wants to who can give me some pros to patches? Well, I guess I've given pros to cons patches. Who can think of some cons to patches?
Sometimes they can conflict with the software and break things, such as Internet Explorer 9 doesn't work with any but the latest version of JAWS.
Or NVDA. But
Actually, I
yes,
believe it was
that's
with
a good
NVDA,
example.
okay. At least the checkboxes part does. When I used it with a student, she was able to use the check she was able to see checkboxes with NVDA, but not JAWS 11.
Yep, that's a good example. Any other cons that people can think of? Bert?
Sometimes a patch is like a short-term fix, and it may be good for most people, and it may be remedying a serious security situation, but for people in certain situations, maybe using certain software or have a network configured in a certain manner, it may not work for them, or it may cause them lots of headaches to get it to work. So, in some of those cases, a lot of times Microsoft will even warn you to take a look under certain conditions, and certainly third-party reviewers will. There's all, you know, if anyone hasn't noticed, there's lots of reviews that come out around the first of the month for Patch Tuesday, and they usually won't help us as far as any accessibility issues, but if you're on a network or in a using any very special proprietary software, it's probably a good idea to study each of those a little bit.
I don't know if Kate's around. I hadn't heard her come in, but anyway, she had an interesting point in her labs that, or I think it was her, or somebody had an interesting point in one of their labs that I was grading, that they used the notify me when updates are available, but don't download them. And they said that they were basically just wanted to know which updates were available, so that way they knew which updates were safe and which weren't. So that way screen reading software and various other software wouldn't break upon downloading and installing updates.
Does anyone here
That's
read
kind
Windows
of what I do.
Secrets? Anyone? Windows
I've never heard.
Secrets? And oh. We pay $10 a year for it, US. You basically, and if you pay for it, you actually get the patch watch columns and stuff. And if you actually wait before pulling the updates down, they review all of the Patch Tuesday patches and tell you about potential issues and stuff and things that might blow up so you can decide whether you're going to put them on. So yeah, windowssecrets.com. It's really cool. And if you don't get the paid one, you don't get the patch watch overview. But it's still good.
Okay. Yeah, and those are good examples. And as was just alluded to, there are different types of ways you can set up updating your operating system. Automatic install, prompt, and manual. Automatic install basically will download all the possible patches and updates and install them automatically. Prompt will, depending on the prompt will basically tell you about them and let you choose what let you choose whether you want to install them or not. And manual basically as it so that and this prompt basically will get them but prompt you to install them, and manual has you connect to the website to download them. I suppose I should have put this in here.
Yeah, Grace is out.
According to the chapter, a service pack you have to get from the website. You have to manually download. I don't think that that's true anymore. Anyone want to correct me on that?
You can actually order a service pack CD from Microsoft, and they're free. My brother did it once.
Right, but I don't think you actually have to go to the website.
Oh, they come down in Windows.
What I was saying is that. Right. I don't think you have to. Because I think the chapter was saying that you had to go. You had to.
They can come as automatic updates. I just, on this virtual machine, I just put Service Pack 3 on and it came to me automatically. You know, and I always choose to select. So you can do it that way, and they're also on third-party sites. And there's lots of ways to get it now, to get them.
In effect, the Windows Update is a website. So,
not anymore.
Okay. Last time
not
I checked,
with Windows 7.
Oh, it's not with Windows 7? Okay.
No.
It is with XP still. You
nope.
Go to
Windows 7. Windows 7 is not a website.
Interesting.
It's got links.
Yeah, with Windows 7 it's a program. It's all on a program now. Which is we have the activity, but I'm almost
You can go ahead and do the activity if you want. Because I mean, if we end up not having any, if we don't have enough time, I'll just start chapter 3 next time.
Well, it's more that I'm not well. I'm kind of conflicted. I think some of the answers are invalid, but. The diagram depicts an activity in which you must identify the three download methods for automatic updates. And The types of installation methods include manual, prompt for permission, or automatic. Your first one is a service pack update is required to correct known functionality and security issues within and within an operating system. You see, the correct answer on this one, did everyone get their answer in? I think we have a pretty small class this week.
I only heard a couple answers come in.
Yeah, but I think that's all we have this week.
That's all we have. I'm here and I'm not answering. And Grace is gone, and whoever we've got left, we've probably got about 3 or 4 people left.
Okay, that must be everybody then.
Alright, the answer
I was on the phone, so
is
I didn't hear the question, sorry.
So yeah, manual, but this is why I'm not, this activity I almost am tempted to call invalid.
Well, let me put a point in here though. According to the chapter, this one should be this one. As much as now it's an automatic one, it should. Yes, that's it. It does follow the text. The chapter does say that service packs are supposed to be downloaded manually, but that's Cisco's answer. And of course, we know that Cisco doesn't
it
always
does
match.
Follow the text.
However, to be
the text
fair, guys,
is out of
yeah. To date. Be fair, though, guys, the thing is that whenever your service pack blows up, which it does for a large majority of people, the first thing it says in the Microsoft knowledge base is download the full service pack from yada 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 and install the service pack manually. So I think that's what they're trying to say to people. You know, a service pack is big enough to warrant you taking the bother to download it manually and actually deploying it. And if you're using a deployment system, that's exactly what you want to do. So whilst they may come down automatic, I've certainly seen those sorts of installs blow up. For those of you where it's worked, I'm very happy for you.
Well, when I upgraded Service Pack 3 on my XP here, I went to the Windows update and I just pulled it down. I said, show me what's express, what's absolutely required, and that's how I did it. So it wasn't an automatic thing, it was me going and getting it and making sure it came down and installed cleanly.
Yeah. Alright, number 2. A user is notified that a new update is available, but decides not to install it based on reports of poor computer performance and after installation. Very good. You all are correct. Alright, a computer automatically accesses a manufacturer's website nightly to check you got the gist. My Brilla display is being wacky, but you got the gist. And that is correct.
One more con I forgot about patches. Unexpected restarts of the computer.
Yeah. That can be fun if you don't see the dialogue pop up when it installs something going, you know, do you want to restart now or later? And I've seen it'll have a time thing. So I'll be buried in a notepad reading away with JAWS and suddenly it's not there anymore.
There is a utility to stop it. There is a freeware utility that will stop those dialogues from ever showing up and will kill the automatic restart dead in its tracks. To find out what it is, subscribe to Windows Secrets, because I can't remember. But it will stop the machine from doing that automatic restart or anything.
Okay. I think it has gotten better anyway. Now it will actually tell me, or it'll at least cause me enough focus issues and rubbish that I'll actually go and look for it and see it. But yeah, under XP it was interesting.
Oh no, it still restarts you at 3 in the morning. Even under 7, it will still restart you at 3 in the morning if you don't touch it.
Okay.
Yeah,
yeah, I don't have mine
download and come back
set
to
do it
password
automatically
prompt.
Anyway.
That's what I did a few days ago.
I'm a control freak. I like mine to tell me what it's doing.
Okay, where are we going from here, guys? Are we finishing on? Are we going moving on to module 3 this morning, or are we? Are we stopping here? It's only 12 past 10. Or have we still got more activity?
It looks like there's a little bit more in chapter 2. I'm not sure if Nehemiah lost his place again, or if Brother's place messed up.
That's all we had other than the chapter quiz, if you guys wanted the chapter quiz.
Okay, there was one section, I just had the chapter pulled up, there was one section on the application patches, which I think you've covered pretty much with the operating system patches, and that was it, and then the chapter quiz.
I didn't have anything else written down, so either it was something I either felt like I covered, or... You know, I think what it was is I had... Oh, you know, that section, I think I felt like I had merged it into another section that I had talked about earlier. And so I didn't talk about it later on.
Well, long story short, applications do require patches just like your operating systems. Most of them are security. Security patches, and it does say in the chapter that, you know, like word processors and browsers are pretty much the most common ones that require them due to the nice, wonderful network attacks that you can get. And of course, check your manufacturer's website. Long story short, do you want me to take the chapter? Do you want me to do the chapter quiz, Nehemiah, or do you want to do it?
Either way. I have it, if...
Okay. I'll let you handle it then.
Alright, just a second. Actually, go ahead. I put that file in the wrong place.
Oh, okay. It's only 5 questions. alright, let me pull up the quiz answers and we'll go. Alright, let me swap over to Vox and we'll take it, and we'll handle it. Will this mess up the recording if I go into settings and swap over?
No, it shouldn't, and I'm recording anyway.
I can do it. I found it. Do you want me to just...
Yeah, it's just, read the questions and then... give the choices, and then it's just like the activities, you just take the answers in chat.
Okay. A network technician needs to install a new operating system on a computer. In order to preserve the data, applications, and configuration settings, and partitioning already present, which installation method should be used? And then your choices are clean installation, upgrade, multi-boot, virtualization. Okay.
And upgrade is the right answer.
Yeah.
According to Cisco.
Well, yeah. Alright, number 2. When developing a naming scheme for a network, which 2 pieces of information are most beneficial when determining a computer name? Choose 2. Device type? Actually, okay.
This would be a yes or no.
Yeah. Do a yes or no on the each choice.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So, device type. And that is correct, as the unanimous vote wished. Location. correct. And I suppose we'll trash the year purchased and operating system and software installed. All right, number three. What portion of operating code interacts directly with the computer hardware? And your possible choices.
Let them go. There's only a few of them. If they can answer it, they can answer
it. Yeah. If you can answer it, I suppose. There are two holdouts. Do you guys want to take a guess too, or?
Damn.
Kernel is correct. The shell is what you interact with. And number four. Which two operating systems issued under the general public license allow end users to modify and enhance code? Choose two. Windows XP, Mac OS X, Linux, BSD. You guys are all doing rather well, yes.
It doesn't say, but there is a thing called the BSD license. And I think they released the code of BSD into the open source arena. The actual code of BSD itself. I'd have to look up the specifics, but that was in the early 90s.
I bet there would be a lot of people happy with Windows XP if they were in open source.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
That'd be cool, actually.
Yeah, especially since it's, like, old and, you know, now... Actually, that'd be kind of cool once it hit, like, no longer supported status. If they would... Once they stopped completely and utterly stopped supporting it. If they would. What three factors...
It's such a good OS, though, man.
It'd be a big business for somebody.
Hey, we all said that about DOS too, Luke. You know, DOS was a great OS, and so was Windows 3.1, and so was Windows 98. And
Windows 3.1 sucked.
Never said that about DOS. 3.1. Was awesome. Never heard anyone say it about 3.1.
DOS 3.1. Was awesome, but Windows 3.1 was smelly.
I knew I'd get a bite. But we all reckon the operating systems are good, and then new ones come out, and then we all adapt and change and. Sometimes it's for the better, and sometimes it's not. But XP's looking pretty old in the tooth.
XP was a good operating system.
A lot of people haven't changed yet, though. A lot of people are still using it around the world, though. A lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I haven't read the percentages in a while, though, but they were still pretty high, like 3 months ago.
Oh, they will. But eventually... there'll be some big internet worm that tears them all apart, and that will pretty much finish them off unless they're not going to go on the net. And in 2011, I can't see a lot of that happening. You're going to find that people are going to be forced to upgrade. It was like the people that clung on to 98 for grim death. It's like, eventually, you got hit by so many trolls.
Well, there are still some people using 98. Every once in a while, I still talk to somebody that, oh, I'm still using 98.
I think I know someone who's still using 95, actually. And they refuse to get rid of it. Well, maybe it's 98, I don't know, but they refuse to get rid of it because their financial management software isn't supported on anything newer and they don't want to learn MYOB. I'm going, guys...
But that's fine, you run it in a virtual machine. That's easy, we do that all the time. It's like, okay, you've got
Xbox but...
Pro, and you stick the whole 98 box in the VM and you run the financial system on your Windows 7.
Yeah, but Kerry, no, trust me, with these people, just no.
Hi guys, it's Barry here. Is that 95 machine? I
saw one person with 95 when I did dial-up support. Sorry, I'll let you continue.
Yeah, the other thing is, and obviously we're not, you know, we're getting off the track of the lecture, so I'm not going to bemoan this, but what you can actually do with VMware Ace and stuff is you can make an icon launch the operating system, and there is no user serviceable, you know, touchable bits. So all of the complexity that you experience with a virtual machine, Luke, is taken out of your hands. We basically super glue all the knobs, switches and dials into one spot and go, there is your financial package that you double click by clicking on that icon. You don't get to play with its innards. And that's what a lot of companies do to take the complexity out of running things in a VM. You don't even know it's in a VM. They don't even tell you. It's that's the best way to handle it if you're in that situation.
Okay. Yeah, that could be cool.
Do you have to have the workstation to do that, though? You can't do that with just a normal VM player.
You need VMware Ace, but it actually builds a standalone virtual machine. And you can run it off thumb drives and removable hard drives and that sort of stuff. But that's not what we're talking about today. But yes, you can. You need workstation to make the Ace, but you can get a student license of workstation, which is quite cheap. I think it's like $75 or something.
All right. Last question. Number 5. What 3 factors need to be considered when choosing an operating system? Choose 3. The operating system has limited availability.
Come on, tiebreaker.
Everyone answered that one.
Yeah.
Okay. I am curious.
The wording stinks, lol, were the last 2 chat messages.
Okay, the operating system has limited availability. I'd like to hear people's views on it, on why they I'm curious to hear what people.
Well, if you can't buy XP licenses, you don't choose it, do you? And that's very soon becoming, like, if you want to buy new XP licenses, that's incredibly difficult to do these days. I'm not talking about all of you who jump on Demonoid and grab the ISO with the remove genuine advantage crack. We know that subset of community exists, but we're not referring to that set of people.
And also the chapter mentioned something about some operating systems, and that, like, won't be imported to certain countries because of copyright and trade laws and everything else. I don't know, but yeah.
It's a bit like Windows 7 Starter. You can't get that if you've got a netbook. You can only get that if you've got a netbook or an OEM agreement. You cannot buy Windows 7 Starter for a desktop.
Though, would you want to?
It's not bad, actually.
Okay.
It'd save a lot of resources.
It's not actually that limited. In fact, I know Sean runs Windows 7 Starter as a primary operating system on his netbook, and if you install anything like Home Premium, the whole thing slows down. I mean, you're limited by the netbook, so, you know, each to their own. You know, you wouldn't necessarily run Ultimate on a netbook. You could.
Mm.
And cry.
Yeah.
Well, what is the limit of what will really run Windows 7 effectively? I mean, I've kind of always thought you needed like 2 gigs of RAM and really something better than an Atom, except for maybe that starter, and if you're not only going to run a couple apps at once. But what would you guys who actually use it say on a regular basis? I mean, I have used it, but I don't have it on any machines personally. What would you guys say the minimum realistic Windows 7 configuration would be?
To be honest with you,
run it.
You go
with a gig and an Atom. I would, if you're gonna be doing much, I would say 2 gigs of RAM, just because Windows 7 is more RAM intensive.
I would also say get a processor that hyperthreads or a multi-core processor, because once JAWS and your software speech that we all are so in love with starts spinning on the primary core, you don't have any core left to do a lot of other stuff. I mean, Eloquence is very heavy on a single core machine in Windows 7. It really bogs it down. And honestly, I had Windows 7 on a couple of my 1.6 gig Atom netbooks with 2 gig of RAM and 500 gig of disk, and I went and stripped it off and put XP back on because it was far faster, it was more responsive. I lost a few features, but hey, them's the breaks.
That is true, though I have been convinced by some that for whatever reason, it does depend on who makes the netbook. I don't know why, but for whatever reason, it seems that I have not been able to figure out this why, but it seems that some netbook makers seem to do some tuning or something to their netbooks that some netbooks turn out to work better.
It's true. It's all to do with how the power management of the Atom processors and stuff is handled and the quality of the underlying chipset components and stuff. But we could do a whole 2 hours on netbooks. We probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
But suffice it to say that the Asuses tend to go fairly good, and the BenQs and the Acers don't tend to as much.
Would that be a good CurvyCast, Kerry? Just an idea.
Maybe, if we get enough interest. I'll float it on the list and see if anyone cares.
The short and long is that A is not considered a correct answer. I was curious to see what people thought about it, though. Because enough people seem to think that it was, that... B. The operating system supports end-user requirements. If anyone had said no to that, I would have cried and resigned my teaching. Good. Sufficient hardware resources are available. That's correct. Users can support the new software without help. You know, I'm going to read you the next answer because I think it's fair. Yeah, I think it's only fair that you guys see the next choice. Human resources exist to support the product, is the next choice. So that's the only problem with trying to give a question this style. Exactly, yeah, there you go.
Well, the problem lies with the question.
And I'm going to read this last one just because it makes me laugh. Yeah, maybe we'll do that in the future. And I have to read this last one just because it makes me laugh. The operating system is backwards compatible with MS-DOS.
Yeah.
Anyone played FreeDOS? Played with FreeDOS? It's kind of cool.
You know, that's one of those things I've been meaning to play with for a long time, just because I loved DOS so much back in the day, and I haven't done it yet. But I keep meaning to.
What is that, an emulator?
No. It's a free implementation of DOS with complete source code for the kernel and everything, and it's got its own command.com and everything. It's actually surprisingly good.
And haven't they been, trying to keep it somewhat up to date and that sort of
yep.
thing? Or at least they were when I saw it last.
So can you run, old DOS programs on it?
Of course. That's the point.
Yeah.
So you'd need a hardware synth or something to get it to talk, wouldn't you?
No, Tyler wrote an application that can use a virtual serial port and a Python script to emulate an Echo speech synthesizer, so you just pass the virtual serial port through to the virtual machine and fire up FreeDOS and run ASAP.
An Echo.
And it will talk. Yeah, well,
oh, wow.
You had to start somewhere.
Oh, I'm just laughing at an Echo. I haven't seen an Echo in years.
It's kind of dodgy. It uses eSpeak to actually drive the Echo. So you basically like send Echo commands at it, and eSpeak actually talks. But he said, yeah, you hook it up with com to com, and then you can actually run a virtual machine and go ASAP com1, and it starts talking in FreeDOS, and it's pretty cool. I haven't got it off him yet, but it's on my list of things.
Wow.
To snuff.
But that's really cool.
Spivey.
Isn't it? Yeah. I don't know. I have a double talk in the other room. Double talk LT. But still, yeah.
And yes, what you were saying about that answer making you laugh, Nehemiah, some of the exam answers, I guess this is for everyone who hasn't maybe seen some of them yet, some of them are absolutely hilarious. You can have a lot of fun doing those exams. Particularly some of the ITE 1 ones are quite good as well.
Someone in Cisco has a sense of humor.
Alright, yeah, some of them do.
I have information on our double talk boards after we're finished here too.
Ooh.
Have we got any more quiz questions?
Nope.
That looks to be it. But my question is, do we really want 15 minutes on one lecture and then the rest on another? I didn't think so.
I'm keen to hit stop at this point. It's not my lecture. Anybody got any pending questions, issues, things that they want to raise before I hit stop?
Has anyone else run into my Windows 7 problem with the Chapter 1 lab? Because Grace fixed it for me last night. Well, apparently I haven't done it yet, but it worked for her, so...
Which one? The printer one?
Yeah, the printer one.
The printer one.
A couple of the Indians have run into it, but they somehow managed to sort it out. I don't know what they did, but... Yeah, we know clicking on the troubleshooter makes it come up.
Okay, yeah, because Grace said make it the default printer and it all comes up. So yeah, I don't know,
I've seen a lot of printer labs come in from the Indians, but I don't know if they're running XP or 7. I'll have to check on that one.
No, I'm in the Discovery printer lab.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. The Discovery printer lab where you've got to install the HP driver and the new tabs magically turn up because the manufacturer driver's got more in it than the Windows default driver. The lab in Chapter 1.
Any further questions?
I'm pushing for that lab to be rewritten for 7, but getting a bit of opposition from the other member of the household. I think we need to write some notes for 7 for that lab, because it'll make future runs through of the course easier, but see what you guys think.
It might be worth it. Then we wouldn't have all the issues that seem to be cropping up with 7.
Most of it is fairly similar, except, yeah, as I say, for me at least, the stuff just didn't appear. But I mean, most of the the buttons and tick boxes and stuff are in a different place, but they're all there. So you end up skipping around the lab doing the steps in a different order. But apart from that, it's, you know, to actually install the thing, I mean.
Yeah, fair enough. Although, to be honest, Luke, there are issues you're seeing on your computer that none of us are seeing on ours. So it makes it somewhat...
Well, yeah, I know. Shoot.
Your inability to ungrab from a virtual is just plain mad, and I cannot... I have no idea what's causing it. Challenging times, but not a lot of the Indians are still running XP, so they don't have those challenges.